In modern moral philosophy, widely credited with inspiring the area now called virtue ethics, Elizabeth Anscombe suggested that we would do well to revive thought about justice and try to work out how it is that an unjust human being is a bad human being. She thought that this might help us break our fixation on the special moral sense of ought, on moral duty, on moral this and moral that. She invited a return to Aristotle for help thinking about justice, and people really have returned to Aristotle, just not with the emphasis on justice that she urged. But the central thread in the paper rests on the thought that we can't do philosophical ethics without being able to theorize moral prohibition. And I personally strongly suspect that she agreed with Peter Geech on the uselessness of turning to Aristotle for help with this topic. Geech remarked, "What you've got on the handout is all the things that I'm quoting in the talk." Quote, "Somebody might very well admit that not only is there something bad about certain acts, but also it is desirable to become the sort of person who needs to act in the contrary way, and yet not admit that such acts are to be avoided in all circumstances and at any price. To be sure, a virtuous person cannot be ready in advance to do such acts, and if he does do them, they will damage his virtuous habits and perhaps irreparably wreck his hard-won integrity of soul. But at this point, someone may protest, are you the only person to be considered? Suppose the price of your precious integrity is a most fearful disaster. Haven't you got a hand to burn for your country or mankind and your friends? This sort of appeal has not, I think, been adequately answered on Aristotelian lines, either by Aristotle or by Mrs. Foote." Close quote. Anscombe also insisted, without much explanation, that some thinkers who held divine law views of ethics were in a good position to address the matters that non-theists were not. As Christopher Coop put it, this is a wonderfully angry essay. It's like Christopher Coop at his curmudgeonly best. Okay, quote, "The point at issue is not well expressed by reciting, the association is all too familiar. If God does not exist, then everything is permitted. It would be less misleading to say that if God does not exist, then nothing is permitted. For the very concept of permitted, where that word has inherited a certain tone, simply falls out of consideration, or at least should do so." Close quote. Anscombe's essay was, of course, a sketch meant to be disconcerting, provocative, and suggestive. I will try to unpack something of what she understood as the conceptual advantage that philosophers had, without entirely noticing it, when concepts like permitted and prohibited had the context non-theist ethics lacked. Now, it helps to pause a moment over moral prohibition just to notice the things she thought had gone missing from Anglophone ethics' field of vision. Now, there are a lot of ways for an otherwise successful act to be bad. My normally good sort of act can be bad under the circumstances, or I can do a good sort of thing to a bad end. But I also can do things that are bad just in virtue of being the kinds of acts that they are. I can lie, for instance, or cheat or steal. Concern over how to understand intrinsically bad acts, acts that are wrong because of the kinds of acts they are, formed the core of Elizabeth Anscombe's tremendously influential complaint against modern moral philosophy. She urged that Anglophone philosophers had lost the ability to cope with ethics We lacked the philosophic equipment that we needed, and she did not know how to make it for us. Our attempts to understand morality had reached a dead end. As near as she could tell, our intellectual landscape had gone perfectly flat when Henry Sidgwick turned his attention to reshaping our field. The many charges she levied against Anglophone moral philosophy cluster around her claim that Anglophone philosophers, like English-speaking people more generally, could no longer make sense of moral prohibitions. She said that we could not make sense of these because we no longer embrace divine law ethics. Divine law, she thought, provides the context in which talk about moral obligation, moral duty, the special moral ought, and so on, does make sense. Without divine law, whose steel spine, she suggested, was moral prohibition, Anglophone philosophical wrangling over what was special about morality was like a finger pointing upward to some authority that we no longer were willing to acknowledge. Now, moral prohibition attaches to fairly determinate kinds of act, just in virtue of the kinds of acts that they are. Anscombe sided with Aristotle and Aquinas in thinking that while there were such things as absolute prohibitions attached to determinate kinds of acts, there were no positive moral requirements attached to determinate kinds of acts. The reason for the asymmetry is easy to see if you pause to think about it. A kind of act that is usually good to do, for instance, making sure that the children have breakfast before they head out the door in the morning, can become bad under the circumstances, for instance, when the house is on fire. We can't stop the world from confronting us with circumstances in which ordinarily good sorts of acts become bad. Prohibitions, on the other hand, do not depend on circumstances. They mark kinds of acts that are always bad, and Anscombe is consistent in holding that recognition of these is crucial to ethics. I will be happy to discuss this point at some length with you if you want to afterwards. I actually agree with her. Complaining about her contemporaries, she wrote, "It is noticeable that none of these philosophers displays any consciousness that there is such an ethic, which he is contradicting. It is pretty well taken for obvious among them all, that a prohibition such as that on murder does not operate in the face of some consequences. But of course, the strictness of the prohibition has as its point that you are not to be tempted by fear or hope of consequences." Close quote. That's the doctrine. It comes into play whenever we are inclined to calculate the likelihood that doing something specifically bad, intrinsically bad, bad because of the kind of action that it is, will result in getting something good or in preventing something worse. Okay, that's the complaint. What happened in the wake of this famous complaint? Where do we stand now? On the whole, mainstream Anglophone moral philosophy is no longer much worried about special moral duties, which must be discharged. Duties that easily can come into conflict and are therefore apt to generate situations in which, as some philosophers still say, one is bound to fail to do as one must. We are not especially worried about, in general, about special moral reasons that automatically outweigh other sorts of reasons, where the other sort used to be marked as usually merely prudential, by which people tended to mean interested and appropriately calculating. Among neo-Kantians, there are still people worrying about understanding acts that are neither required nor prohibited, but are, as people still say, permissible. And even those philosophers influenced by Anscombe's call to arms tend not to give much thought about actions or duties obligation attaching to kinds of actions or duties at all these days. These are the ones who are the friends of Anscombe. They sort of left that to the side. Being much more drawn toward the kind of detailed moral psychology derided by Christopher Coop in the essay I quoted, or taking it that they can be in line with work by Anscombe if they focus on goods rather than the things done for the sake of or in pursuit of some good. It has become habitual to refer to accounts based on either goods or else something called the good to describe what they're doing as teleological accounts. Anscombe's work is teleological in a more traditional sense of being concerned with ends, with one or another sort of telos, that kind of teleological. Now, some friends of Anscombe have mounted serious criticism of the suggestion that focus on ends can be replaced by thought about good or about goods, normally treated as focused on abstract discussions of, say, friendship or aesthetic enjoyment or justice or some such. Others take up something of the spirit of her work, but direct their attention to actions or reasons for acting in the supposition that such topics can be pursued in the absence of any substantive traffic with the stuff of normative ethics. In practice and in print, Anscombe provided fuel to argue that the attempt to do work on action, intentional action, or reasons for acting without muddying the waters with moral concern was unlikely to work. But that's another story. The short story I've sketched is meant only to suggest that times have changed. Anscombe was a spur to some of that change. For all that, it's worth pausing to think about the old godless moral philosophy and the shape of the hole she found in the middle of it, the hole that Anscombe thought could be filled by divine law. Okay. Now, when I gave an earlier draft of this paper very recently, at a workshop, Robert Adams asked why on earth Anscombe had not just made the argument that we should return to theism and ethics if we wanted to do moral theory, period. That it was coy, disingenuous, and possibly two-faced of her not to do so. He got very riled up about this. Now, I don't know why she did not use her complaints as an occasion for evangelical intervention. Okay. Perhaps it was partly because some of her contemporary opponents, most notably R.M. Hare, were Christians, very devout, practicing Christians. Perhaps she sensed how unlikely it was that Anglophone philosophers would abandon their gentleman's agreement to avoid adverting to God in their work, whether or not they were religious. Whatever the case, Anscombe's essay is based on the thought that the absence of intellectual commitment to God as the almighty creator and legislator, these distinct, as you could say, divine names are deeply interrelated for members of the Anscombe-Geach family, that left moral philosophy wandering in the darkness. And I'm going to try to say why she thought this. Anscombe drew central features of her broad picture of divine law ethics from Aquinas on natural law. Part of the excavation part of this book has been trying to figure out how on earth she's reading Aquinas, partly with help by serious scholars working on Aquinas. What we know from her kids is that she constantly read Aquinas. What we know from her conversation with various people, her children and a couple of students, is that she thought that it was not a good idea to mention Aquinas in print because If you did, people would just ignore the interest of the thought you were describing, fixating on the name. And they would do that whether they were big fans of Aquinas or deeply opposed. It didn't matter. Those that were for and those who were against ignored the interest of the thought. So she deliberately avoided writing about Aquinas, but apparently read him all the time. Okay, Aquinas on Natural Law. In this connection, she writes elsewhere, quote, "Any type of wrong action is against the natural law. Stealing is. Framing someone is. Oppressing people is. Natural law is simply a way of speaking about the whole of morality used by Catholic thinkers because they believe the general precepts of morality are laws promulgated by God, our Creator, in the enlightened human understanding when it is thinking in general terms about what are good and what are bad actions. That is to say, the discoveries of reflection and reasoning, when we think straight about these things, are God's legislation to us, whether we realize this or not." Close quote. The Creator's ordination governing the whole of creation is eternal law. Natural law, for Anscombe and Aquinas, is how the rational animal participates in eternal law. Now, it could be objected that even if we go along with talk of law when we are thinking about creatures with intellects and free wills, the sorts of things that could, you know, go against them, these laws, disobey, human beings and angels being the likely two examples in this particular thought world, we ought not to use the term law to talk about, say, gravity, or more generally, the kinds of regularities that order the lives of non-human species of animals, or that are at work in chemical reactions. We shouldn't use the term law to talk about the status of regularities that might be tracked in mathematical treatment of quantum entanglement or something, the kind of thing exploited by scientists who are working on developing those quantum computers. I mean, from the point of view of members of the Anscombe-Geach family, if I understand them, these laws belong to eternal law promulgated in the order of the natural world. As Mary Geach once put it, these are, quote, descriptions under which the creation was intentional, close quote. It is beyond the scope of this paper and my meager grasp of contemporary physics, chemistry, and biology to mount an argument about the appropriateness of talk of laws in science. It's not a thing I know how to do. My aim is rather to excavate Anscombe's works, trying to explain the place that discussion of natural law and eternal law had in her work in practical philosophy. For Anscombe, there were both moral laws and laws of nature, and both sorts of laws were from God. There are various things that we might note about the juxtaposition of her remark about morality and natural law with her complaints in modern moral philosophy. First, contrary to some recent work on natural law, Anscombe suggested that morality and natural law alike are articulated in general thought about good and bad actions, rather than through general thought about various goods. Many contemporary theorists interested in natural law stress things that are good for people to have, to get, to promote, to use, or to enjoy. Anscombe's work tends instead to focus on what is good or bad for a human being to do. The interest throughout her work is in voluntary intentional action, I'll just call these acts, and she shared Aquinas' thought that an act is good just in case it isn't bad, meaning of an intrinsically bad kind or bad under the circumstances or done to a bad end. If it's not bad, it's good. If it's bad in any of these ways, it's bad. It's kind of simple, although the casuistry gets pretty complicated. Let's see. So, you know, if you sort of retain the traditional distinction between, say, acting well and faring well, and direct your attention to the acting well side, this view of good and bad in human action can take you in either of two very extreme directions. It can allow you to say that many people act well most of the time. That's the way Christopher Koop goes with it. People act well almost always. Most people almost always, almost all the time act well. That's not quite a direct quote from that essay, but it's really close. Like, calm down. On the other hand, it can lead you to conclude that hardly anyone ever acts well, ever. It's just virtually impossible. The way you go with this thought is going to depend on how you understand the scope of an act's circumstances and how you distinguish kinds of acts. Much of the clamor against the essay in which Anscombe made her remark about morality and natural law involved a quarrel over the distinction between a kind of act and its circumstances. The focus on acts is consistent in Anscombe's writings and underscores one perfectly ordinary aspect of the legality of divine law ethics. The letter of law normally governs conduct, policy, its implementation, and so on. And although neither the sphere of thou shalt not nor the sphere of do such and such is, as one says, strictly codifiable, and although no one could have a sound ethics built of nothing but prohibitions, the prohibitions are especially important. Prohibitions, Anscombe urged elsewhere, tend to be so deeply embedded in moral education that it is hard to see how one could have any grasp of central concepts, property, for instance, or persons, rights or respect, kindness or loyalty, and so on, without practical understanding of the surrounding prohibitions. I take it that this is part of the point of her invention of the term stopping modals, to cover the practical knowledge and teaching at issue in understanding the concepts of rules, rights, and promises, and the force involved in strong statements of counsel. Stopping modals aren't just, you can't use that, it's Stevens, things like that. They're also things like, you can't wear that. That's another of her examples. I mean, you think Anscombe didn't take this advice very often. if you've ever heard about her sartorial decisions. Anyway, of course, the relations between specific goods that could be sought in one way or another and the things done in order to secure, promote, make possible, or otherwise aid the unimpeded or appropriately limited access to or enjoyment of those goods will also belong to ethics, as will concern about emotions and thoughts and attitudes. But Anscombe focuses on what is done in pursuing good and avoiding bad. Her topic in the essay from which the natural law quotation is taken is the condemnation of contraceptive sexual intercourse. Her examples in modern moral philosophy include acts whose name implies badness, as an Aristotelian might put it, adultery, murder, bilking, and so on. The elusive special moral ought, the thing she thinks divine law ethics has and non-theist ethics can't get, is, she thinks, quote, a notion of obligation which only operates in the context of law, close quote. As near as I can tell, although in modern moral philosophy, Anscombe makes mention of unspecified Stoics and of Judaism, and although she might not be unsympathetic in turning to Hobbes in thinking about natural law, a turn that Geach found helpful, her understanding of law comes fairly directly from Aquinas. For Aquinas, law is an ordination of reason for the common good promulgated by him who has care of the community. This definition is meant to be perfectly general. It is meant to cover eternal law, natural law, and positive law alike. The laws that we seek to understand in contemporary science will be articulations of aspects of the eternal law governing order in nature. Some of us may find this just a bad definition of law. People don't like this definition of law. A lot of people who do legal philosophy hate this definition of law, I gather. I'm going to leave the question of the adequacy of the definition to one side. My concern is what Anscombe may have taken from Aquinas. As near as I can tell, the Thomist understanding of natural law is consistent in Anscombe's work. In her youthful foray into this topic, written with Norman Daniel in 1939, we find, quote, "This idea of a natural moral law is one which modern men have lost, but without it they cannot live in peace with themselves or socially or internationally. For natural law is the law of man's own nature, showing how he must choose to act in manners where his will is free, if his nature is to be properly fulfilled. It is the proper use of his functions. Their misuse or perversion is sin. So lying is the misuse of speech and is therefore wicked. So justice is the proper working out of relations between man and man and between societies, each having its due. To those who believe in God, it will rightly appear that his law, the eternal law, has its reflection in the ordered activity of creation, that law of nature which is the truth of things. In man, this activity is not wholly determined, but there is an element of choice. Thus far, to him the law is proposed, it is not imposed on him. But it is no less law for that. It binds because it is the law of his nature, and in what it consists, one can discover by reason, checked and guaranteed by the divine revelation of Scripture. Aquinas called it the participation in the eternal law of the rational creature, the law in him from his creation, which he, making use of the gifts of reason and revelation, will find for his salvation." Close quote. It's very early. Some recent work on natural law allows the emphasis on God to recede into the background. And a reader of Aquinas might wonder why it is one needs the eternal law in this picture. The question may seem especially acute for those who notice that mention of eternal law seems to recede into the distance when Aquinas turns his attention to specific precepts of natural law in the Prima Secundi, question 94. Perhaps Aquinas is just making a necessary theological nod in God's direction, a God that we can notice, respect, then move past. And readers of Anscombe might notice that God seems not to figure at all in her own substantive engagements with questions about, say, the obligation to do one's word, or questions about moral authority, or such matters as the obedience owed to the state, or the duties associated with respect for rights and rules. I will begin by taking up the question with respect to Aquinas and then return to Anscombe. Stephen Brock gives a nice summary of the troubles that flow in if God steps away from natural law ethics. Quote, "An account of natural law that makes no mention of God or of the eternal law still presents, can such an account still present natural law as a law in the full Thomistic sense? It is easy at first glance to give a formulation of natural law in terms of the general definition of law when some reference to divine legislation is permitted. But without such a reference, it becomes difficult to see how to apply almost any of the elements of the definition of law to the case of natural law. Who holds the position of the one who has care of the community? Who promulgates natural law? Also, if its author is not God, then the community to which natural law is promulgated can hardly be the universe. What community takes its place? Toward what common good will it aim? Even the first element of the definition, an ordination of reason, is thrown into some doubt. For by this expression, Aquinas intends a certain kind of command. But there can be no command where there is no commander, and it is at least problematic to say that natural law is a command issued by each man's own natural reason. One problem connected with the question of the community would be that a natural law issued by man's own reason would be a law that governs exactly one man. A more serious problem arises from the fact that if natural law is a command issued by man's own reason, then it all depends upon his choice to pursue the things commanded. But natural law is supposed to consist precisely in the principles of all deliberation, practical judgment, and reasonable choice. Close quote. What sort of command is the sort at issue in eternal law? I take it that for Aquinas, eternal law is the sort of command that unites creation and legislation. Aquinas writes, "The eternal law is nothing else than the ratio of divine wisdom as directing all actions and movements." Close quote. God sets the terms for motion and for actions, in the sense actualizations of potentialities or powers on this view. He sets the terms in the sense the ends toward which kinds of creatures are directed, what it belongs to them to head toward, and he sets the terms in the sense standards by which motions and actualizations of powers are measured. Intellectual creatures have a choice in some matters involving motion and actualization, but not in others. I can no more set the basic structure of practical reason for myself than I can decide to get home tomorrow by tapping my heels together 3 times and reminding myself that there's no place like home. I cannot determine the standards to which my reasoning is answerable, neither in the case of the practical use of my reason, nor in the case of the theoretical or speculative use of my reason. Given such standards and my direction qua human being, however, it is in my power to act well or fail to do so. Okay, one might say, Anscombe may go along with Aquinas on this point, but it's not as though all questions are settled if we keep eternal law in the picture. We still need a sufficiently developed theological view to cope with, you know, Aquinas on analogy in such a way that we have a developed account of the relevant sort of command. We also will want a clear understanding of the difference between, say, God's command that Abraham sacrifice his only son, having promised Abraham that he would father many generations, the sort of command that is not general, right, distinguish that from the commands involving general matters that the members of the Anscombe-Geech family treat as these descriptions under which the creation was intentional, and the general commands that are proposed rather than imposed and set terms for being a good human being. We also will want to understand how I could be said to be following God in avoiding wronging my fellow human beings without knowing that this is a good description of what I'm doing. We want to know, for example, what is it that I can fail to grasp and still be said to be acting in obedience. Anscombe follows Aquinas, I think, in taking it that I need not know that God is the source of the standards by which my intentional actions are measured. I do not even need to have an articulate account of the ends served by abiding by those standards, by the standards articulated in what Aquinas understood as the primary and secondary precepts of the natural law. To move around in the world well and act well, I do not need to know these things, and I certainly don't need special revelation of something like, you know, the character of the Trinity or whatever. I mean, I don't need special revelation for this. Okay. But the philosopher, I think she thinks, needs to grapple with the question of ends served by following the precepts. In order to understand the character of those positive families of actions and activities that tend to be morally good, like keeping my promises, obeying the positive laws governing the institutions of property in my neck of the woods, or seeing to the moral education of my children. What the philosopher needs to appreciate about these matters is that the good at issue in them is the common good of some human community. We do not have absolute positive requirements attaching to these kinds of acts for the reasons I've mentioned. What philosophers have, however, is the possibility of exploring the character of the common good at stake in these regions of morality and articulating the ways in which promising or property or parental responsibility for the moral education of children serves the relevant common good. One does not need any such theory in order to follow the relevant precepts of the natural law. Okay, well, if we had all that and a good story about the sense in which God promulgates law in nature, then maybe we would have a philosophically satisfying, theologically adequate account of properly moral obligation as Anscombe understands this. But that is a pretty tall order. And it is not a project that Anscombe took on systematically or even very directly in print. In short, it's not as though simply adverting to divine law is enough to make sense of how it was that this sort of Thomistic divine law ethics provides the needed account of moral obligation, the one that illuminates what is special about moral obligation, makes sense of moral prohibition and moral permissibility alike, and provides the right context for ethics. What it does give us, I think, is a sketch of the character of the theistic ethics at issue behind the scenes in vast swaths of Anscombe's work. Now, it could be that the kind of obligation signaled by the special moral ought, the sort that makes sense of both permissible acts and prohibited kinds of acts, is more likely to find a home in natural law as the way the rational animal participates in eternal law than it will find elsewhere. It is at least a place to start. But Anscombe thought some about alternative ways of trying to understand the foundations of morality and of moral obligation. And she gives them pretty short shrift. So I'm going to run through a collection of the cryptic bits. Anscombe considers and objects to four areas that she thinks we might be tempted to go and look for, in search of support for an account of the foundations of morality that will help us get a grip on special character of moral obligation. One, introspective moral psychology and social norms. Quote, Butler exalts conscience but appears ignorant that a man's conscience can tell him to do the vilest things, close quote. That's from Modern Moral Philosophy. And by the same token, considering whether the second nature of acculturation to social norms might give us a place to start, quote, but just as one cannot be impressed by Butler when one reflects what conscience can tell people to do, so I think one cannot be impressed by this idea if one reflects on what the norms of a society can be like, close quote. Neo-Kantian moral theory, this is the famous one. Quote, Kant introduces the idea of legislating for oneself, which is absurd. The concept of legislation requires the superior power of the legislator, close quote. Consequentialist moral theory. In coining the term consequentialism and explaining the fault that it names, she takes herself to have shown why it will be useless to try to account for morality as productive of good outcomes. The place of estimating outcomes in ethical judgment is the kind of thing that moral philosophy should explain. What we need to explain includes the following ubiquitous teaching of common sense. One is responsible for the bad consequences of deliberate bad acts, but gets no credit for their good outcomes. One gets credit for the good consequences of a good act, but when a good act goes bad, then the fault lies not with the doer or the deed, but with something else. And finally, one is permitted to risk more when faced with morally hostile circumstances than one can ordinarily. 4, social contract theory. What is needed to understand the special force of the special moral ought goes well beyond the bounds of anything that could come of the authority of contract, Anscombe thought. Quote, contractually conceded authority must be voluntary, and it terminates when the contract does. But the moral case, like the case of the authority of the state, is one where the subjects of authority are so willy-nilly, close quote. Which is really yay saying, nay saying. I mean, that's willy-nilly. Social contract thought does not envision the end of the contract. Sometimes, because it seeks to appeal to timeless reason or standards of reason, on the assumption that each new generation of rational animals will sign on by seeing the sense of the arrangement, and so on. Now, it's one thing to have this as a sort of model that might give you some grounds for state authority, where your principal concern is with matters like political stability and relative security. That's one kind of thing. To try to develop a moral theory from it is another thing entirely. Okay, a kind of thing that Rawls was really sensitive to, and his most famous student has worked around, treating Tim Scanlon as the most famous student. Generally, I can cooperate pretty effectively in a group of people, do my part in common projects and things like that, and privately think, Sue is an idiot. Or, there goes George, again, at it. He's just gonna run that thing to the ground. I wonder what's gonna happen next. There's no problem for my participation in a political group where I don't take seriously the reasons that other people find compelling for their action. You can't have that element of detachment from what the other folks take to be worth doing and why when you're doing moral theory. You can't just step back. Now, there may be other ways of handling the special character of morality, of accounting for moral prohibition, and so of making some headway with the problems Anscombe sketched in 1958 and returned to again and again in various ways for the rest of her life in philosophy. But I take it that the problems she raised for moral philosophy were genuine and serious, and that the glimpses she gives us of her understanding of divine law ethics shine some light on the kinds of things we might need in order to address the problems she brought to our attention. Thank you.
So, let's go to questions. Normal rules apply. Grad student questions first.
Right. Thank you. I was wondering if you could say something about how, on Anscombe's view, some kinds of acts can both be intrinsically bad, while at the same time ultimately being bad in virtue of God's commands.
The intrinsically bad ones. Um,
helps here to work backwards a little bit. She, in general, thinks that there are certain kinds of tasks that any human community is going to need to make provisions for. Prominent among these are things like bringing into being the next generation of humans, without whom the society doesn't continue at all. And she understands marriage and systems of kinship as ways by which specific local human communities are organizing that piece of sort of vital moral labor, without which nothing. So what she thinks is that, she says in a really nice paper called The Warm Environment of Your Child, is that at the time you actually get hold of a concept like marriage, you also automatically get hold of a concept like adultery, which means all kinds of sexual activity outside the limits that are set by whatever the marital, I mean, and she's, that the natural law is supposed to be available to ordinary human reflection as concerning kinds of things that it makes sense for us to do. And then if it's contrary to something completely basic in the set of menu of tasks that a human being has to, human society has to figure out how to do, those will tend to be places where there's an absolute prohibition attaching to acts that are contrary to it. Now, she doesn't feel that way about the obligation to keep promises, even though she takes this piece of, she says, there's a million excusing conditions on a promise. It's needful in human life that we have a way of finding the future by word and things like that. So promise keeping really tends to be good to do. It is also task directed. But you have to go right at absolutely basic aspects of human life to get all the way up to prohibition. So, for example, a thing that humans have always done is kill other human beings. It is hard to conceive a functioning human society that doesn't distinguish some cases of kinds of killing of human beings by other human beings as absolutely beyond the pale, and other kinds of killings of human beings as okay, right? We need a sorting mechanism there. And as far as I know, there's no evidence that there's ever been a human society that didn't have such a sorting mechanism. In that sense, it looks like a prohibition on the kind of thing that we mark with the term murder is completely central to the natural, completely central to the operation of human society. And the ones that she takes to be absolutely prohibited in the natural law are going to be right down at the absolute core of things like security in the person, the ability to bring forward a new generation of human beings, I mean, there, and get them equipped to engage in society, that kind of thing. The other stuff floats over. It's not the stuff of absolute prohibition. Now, lying, she was of the view that because people had gone really soft on lying, and were, you know, they thought, oh, so that I don't hurt your feelings, that's a good enough reason to just tell you of all of this lie. Something like that. They found really soft on lying, they found really soft on adultery, and given the conduct of war that Tucson World War II and stuff, they seem even to have gone really soft on murder. So it must be that no one understands any moral prohibitions anymore. I think that was false. And I think it was unwarranted, but I think you have to look in a different place to see where they do crop up, sort of at the core of practical reason. I don't know if I'm getting anywhere near, but it's like basic stuff about security in your person, these tasks without which the society doesn't last past the current generation, are connected to modes of order in human life that are the stuff that the violent act and contrary to which gives you an actual prohibitive act. And an awful lot of morality is not that strenuous, she thinks. Is that helpful?
I still find it difficult to see how all these considerations fit in with God's commands.
Oh.
Just because, even in these cases where there's a total prohibition, is it not correct to say that ultimately it's because God prohibits these things? In which case, I'm wondering why are they then intrinsically bad, rather than just bad by decree?
Oh, thank you, but it never occurred to me.
The way you put it originally, if I'm right, is how is it both that an action is bad in itself and bad because God prohibits it?
For somebody who's a friend of Aquinas, at least as much as I think she was, you have to do a kind of thing that somebody who was as schooled in Wittgenstein as she almost never does. You have to do actual metaphysics to get this. You have to have there be such a thing as the nature of a human being. And that has to be such that if there's two things that have to be true for the human. It has to be such that the human being is ordered in a particular sort of a way. There's a way the bits, the powers and capacities are supposed to work together. And there's the fact that they don't automatically do that for most of us. If one possible exception, I don't believe I've ever met an entirely well-governed human being. Completely, utterly, this is totally, perfectly self, and so on this kind of view, God both sets the terms for what it would mean for this kind of thing to be well ordered, both as an individual and in society. That's built into what it is to be a human being. And that's what is built into being a creature. When I said creator and legislator are not distinct names of God for these people, that's kind of how that's the case. There's this place in Aquinas, I'm not going to be able to give you chapter and verse, unfortunately, on being a mercenary is not a proper soul. But there's this point where Aquinas notes that we can tell we don't know what a hawk is because we can't make one. Right? That's a vision of the combined work of creation and legislation that is at issue in the making of different species of living things. On this way of reading Aquinas. The person who's developed this reading, the most fully contemporary person, is a guy who teaches at Santa Croce in Rome called Stephen Groff. You've got a quote from his doctoral dissertation on the handout. As near as I can tell, Groff's work on Aquinas is as close to, Anscombe is heading where he is, as near as I can tell. He wanted to know. Who's Aquinas? Anscombe. Steve Brock's is a good place to start.
So I no longer like to defend Kant, but You mentioned the Pentagon says that it is nonsense to think of self-legislation.
Yes.
But I was just wondering, in the case of God, if I understand the problem correctly, if God is a legislator, if God decides what is good, then by his action, so it can go into voluntarism if it's just whatever he does is good, or if goodness is independent from God, then God is not omnipotent. So the normal solution that I hear is, well, there's the God's intellect that decides what is good, and God's will that chooses what is good, therefore protecting both God's goodness and God's omnipotence. So that sounds like self-legislation.
This is, okay, this, you can wade pretty deep into various theological waters where I'm over my head in all of this. I'm not, by training or anything, a prophet theologian. But for these people, God is the good. So, and that good is diffusive. And it's diffused through the whole of the creation. And there's no way to make a kind of creature here that doesn't involve also making what it would mean for that creature, that created substance, to operate appropriately.
Yeah. No, okay. I'm not questioning. I'm just questioning she said that you cannot have self-legislation.
Oh,
that it made no sense.
You don't think about God as legislating in that sense. For himself, God is the attributes.
And it doesn't fall into voluntarism, because that's my concern. Like normally, I think that's what Luther did, and he just fell into voluntarism that seems to deny God's goodness. And I think Calvin did implicitly deny it.
Again, this is not a place where.
Sorry.
This is the place where my colleague Jennifer would be able to answer the question appropriately. But I'm not a student of this, of that kind of work. I read Aquinas, around the edges of Aquinas, for the sake of understanding Aquinas better. Aquinas initially, because I wanted to figure out who was the real ghost writer of the convention, given that it couldn't have been Aristotle. And thinking to myself, well, devout Catholic, probably Aquinas. So that's how it started doing the point.
AJ?
So I was curious if you could say something more about sort of the dialectical role that Aquinas's implication of the importance of absolute prohibitions plays, specifically in modern moral philosophy, and maybe also more broadly in her work. So I guess whenever I have read modern moral philosophy, it always seems very strange to me that Anscombe invokes this idea, which she explicitly acknowledges, that a lot of her interlocutors would reject, and it's not clear whether she thinks her readers would be that sympathetic to the idea either. So I'm just curious, like, what would that seem to be like?
Why did she do that? She partly does it because she thinks that's the big thing that's gone missing. There's an ability to work on that and think in terms of that. She doesn't make various of the dialectical moves one can make in support of supposing that there are such things as moral prohibition. There's a lot of them you can make in connection with this. Speaking of somebody who's tried to figure out how to do it without mentioning divine law at all a bunch, spent several years working on it. But as a quick motivator, you might notice that if you don't take it, that some kinds of acts are in fact as such prohibited or never to be done. We don't have any absolute prohibitions. Your ideal moral agent in sufficiently hostile circumstances, and philosophers can always make it so that the circumstances are as hostile as you please, could do anything. In sufficiently baroque, whacked out circumstances, you could produce a situation in which it looked as though your ideal, really, truly rightly responsive moral agent could intersect all the kids in the local daycare. I mean, it's the usual way philosophers generate these things. It would be to avoid the situation in which a whole lot of other people have intersected all the kids in seven or eight other local, all the ones in Manhattan, too, not just New Haven. Right. I mean, so it's always possible to cook up a situation where it becomes very hard. I mean, that's the force of Beach's remark. It does not seem enough to say that anybody who was prepared to do this couldn't be properly virtuous. And there's an odd sense in which, when Bernard Williams confronts the question in the Jim and the Jungle example, and his wife is trying to find a way to say that I'm not being morally self-indulgent just because I refuse to execute one villager under these circumstances. He has to invoke thought about my character and my integrity and how important it is to everybody that we raise people who will say no to taking out the one villager under these kinds of circumstances. It is, and you know, later kind of took it back in conversation with somebody and said, well, actually, I probably should. But it's very hard to, on the one hand, there's this core intuition that there's some kinds of things that you just don't do. Okay? Just not like diamonds in the daylight, you just don't, it's just never, we just, it's not done. Right. Or any other matter of etiquette where things are just not done. You have a feeling there's more to be said here. There's something really substantive. And trying to get at the substance requires that the substance be generating a very powerful kind of obligation. Does that make sense? Usually an obligation not to do a thing.
I guess, well, I can really deal with all of those intuitions. However, it seems like in modern moral philosophy, and so there's a dialogue with folks who don't really feel the pull of any of those intuitions. That's precisely what she finds so disturbing about the 1930s, 1940s era British moral philosophy, which she's in dialogue with.
Every moral philosopher since Sidgwick has been Jesus.
Everybody since Sidgwick, and Sidgwick is born.
And so I was wondering in what way she needs for an indication of the idea of absolute moral prohibitions to come into contact with what?
What was the positive result she thought might happen? Well, well, I mean, I think that the work on justice and figuring out how to say how it is that you can get it out that an unjust man is a bad man. That was the sort of place she thought we might look. Thinking, I think, rightly, that most of the places where people were going on about special moral obligation and special moral ought and so on was in matters of justice. That where justice, that was the place where people were feeling there's a special kind of duty here. And I take it that her plea to develop the needed philosophic equipment with God gone, I think that was a genuine request. I mean, I don't think that she was so duplicitous that she was sort of saying, and while you're at it, you know, square root of -1. I mean, you know, this was actually, we need to figure out how to do this, because she's supposing that she's still talking to reasonable people who have a sense that this is a significant cost. And the invention of the term consequentialism, it in fact covers not just what the term came to mean, which was that I try to decide what's right, wrong, good, bad in terms of some outcomes or something, which is what people came to mean by the term consequentialism. It had to do with an inability to distinguish intended and merely foreseen outcomes, so the stuff of double effect. And those go together. Paying attention to moral prohibition and paying attention to double effect go together. Because you need to be able to mark the difference between my doing a prohibited kind of act and my doing a thing that has the sort of result that a prohibited kind of act might have. You need to be able to tell those apart. You need it for practical reason. I mean, one of the ways you can tell when locals in your neck of the woods are respecting a moral prohibition is in terms of the tremendous attention they pay to trying to figure out what acts are going to count as instances of the prohibited type. So, if you look at, from the time the term was coined, genocide, and the variety of kinds of attention that have been paid to trying to determine whether this or that counts as genocidal, it's really important to know what counts, because this is a prohibited type of act. The term was invented to cover a prohibited type of act. It wasn't like usually bad, but not like there's not very many of them, and they're really filthy, and no one would miss them, and everybody, you know, it's really never okay. Rape, if you think about the last 30 or 40 or maybe even 50 years of discussion over what kinds of things are going to count as instances of rape, the very anxiety around trying to tell the difference between which kinds of things are and which are not acts of rape. I'm so old that marital rape wasn't strictly speaking the case that people thought that a husband, usually a husband, could rape his wife on account of doesn't marriage give you conjugal access? You didn't know what the thing does, and so how could one spouse read him? Those kinds of things count as attempts to understand instances that belong to a prohibited type. So she's thinking that however much she rails against her colleagues, she's railing against people who are in a position to appreciate the seriousness of this topic and to begin to get a sense of what kind of thing is lost if you can't tell the difference between the guy who has to go to prison or do something disgraceful, where going to prison is going to mean that he can't support a minor child over here, and the guy that just deliberately withdraws support from a minor child. If you can't sort those things out, it's a little hard to actually grapple with ethics, that kind of thing. And she's thinking that her colleagues are perfectly capable of noticing that, even though she and Geach were constantly saying they should be horsewhipped, and they were constantly saying that they'd love to bring her scrawny back.
So thank you very much. I wanted to ask you about one strand of the talk that I was interested in about, you said that Anscombe tended to focus on doing well, as opposed to other people who focus on what's good for human beings or on faring well. And I was wondering if that would be a dichotomy that Anscombe would accept. So on her reading of Aristotle and Thought and Action in Aristotle, she thinks that the project of Nicomachean and Ethics is to show that virtuous living coincides with the life of eudaimonia. Some people read that in just 1:7, but I think that's implausible. She reads it as being the project of the eudaimonia, of the Nicomachean Ethics. I was wondering if you thought that maybe she would think that she would be engaged on this kind of project of trying to show that the life of good action of eupraxene coincided with the life of happiness, which I think is something like that you find in Aquinas as well.
You don't entirely find it in either one of them.
You have the external
views. They were, I mean, there were murders, for example, and there's no guarantee that acting well is going to lead to faring well. That's part of why it's a hard nut to crack. I don't know. I mean, Anscombe did classics. I don't know how much the daimon in eudaimonia is influencing her there. It is not an unreligious concept in Greek, I think. Although we've now treated it as something like faring well. But, I mean, good and bad in particular, acts versus acting well, those are different. She certainly thinks that virtue and acting well hook up. She certainly thinks that. She is, if you read her on the lot of human beings and what their lives tend to be like and stuff, and take that seriously, she thinks that really a lot of people are not faring well. They're not. And she doesn't think that it's necessarily a stain on my character if I'm distressed in various ways. And it certainly wouldn't be a stain on my character if I found myself, because I was genuinely working on behalf of justice or something like that, in a pretty serious way, if I found myself penniless, sick, and friendless. But neither Aristotle nor Anscombe is going to insist that a person who is starving, friendless, and outcast, provided that her hard-won integrity is intact and she's acting well in the face of all this, is thereby happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to. There's a line of Stoicism where that seems to be the case, but that is not her view or Aristotle's view or really Aquinas' view. Mm-hmm. And like Aquinas, I think this is true of Aquinas, and I think she thinks this is true of Aquinas. She recognizes the possibility of pagan virtue. So, you know, it's...
You have?
So, when you talk about the natural law, you refer to the common good, mm-hmm. like the natural law is kind of based on the common good, so based on how the community may fare. And then the natural law really governs is the human action, and which type of action is permissible, which type of action is not permissible. Then is this the framework kind of like a consequentialism on a higher level? So you work on the overall good, based on the overall good, and you figure out what type of action is permissible
action. No, that's not it.
Yeah.
That's
I'm just trying to clarify.
No, I mean, the divine law part comes from the legislator who has the care of the community. That's God in the case of eternal law, and it's God in the case of natural law as our participation in the eternal law. That's the thing that has care of the community and the common good in sight, okay? Makes the things for whom this is common good, right? Now, in positive law, it's a much more local community. So it's the good of Chicago or something, or the good of the department, or I mean, it's like there are smaller communities where the common good could be there, right? But it's not that I am to act by trying to see how this all fits in the divine plan or something. That would be madness, right? I mean, it's supposed to be promulgated in natural reason, which is one of the reasons that somebody like Christopher Coop thinks that really most people are acting well most of the time. For example, they feed themselves, right, when they're hungry. For example, they love their children. For example, you know, they do all these things, and all of that belongs to acting.
Yeah, I know, like when they act, they only think about the type of the action, like the nature of the action. But eventually, why those type of action is permissible is based on whether it promotes the common good.
That's going the wrong way. I mean, if you're thinking of the common good as what's good for a bunch of folks, right? Scapegoating, in some sense of good, might be good for a bunch of folks. Part of the reason that you might single out some group of people and hold them accountable for the dire state that our society is in or something, get rid of those, would be to sort of promote a sense that we've got rid of the bad, we've made space for the good, we can enjoy each other, blah, blah, blah. On an ordinary understanding of common good as just like aggregate or statistically majority or something like that, I can be acting for the common good in this sense if I'm in this sense of avoiding doing an act that's prohibited, in that sense of acting for the common good. If what I'm doing brings ruin to my family, doesn't actually alter the political landscape I'm in, right? Doesn't all by itself change any of the bad that's going on, right? I mean, suppose I'm somebody like Thomas More, I'm asked to sign a document. If I sign the document, my family's going to be fine, I'm going to be fine. If I refuse to sign the document, it's not like the bad thing that's happening is going to stop. It's not like the person who's doing the thing I take to be blasphemous is going to change course. None of that stuff is going to, and yet it can count in this sense as doing as I ought to refuse to sign the document, especially provided that I tried ways around bringing it to that kind of a head, which that case we did. Does that make sense? So you wouldn't normally see that as toward the common good. To see it as toward the common good, you would have to see that particular kind of act that I take to be both a lie and blasphemous as prohibited. Does that help?
This is funny, but I think it's so important to be recovering the whole outcome, and I think you're right that it's Aquinas that's standing behind all of this. I'm less sure that she is getting Aquinas on natural law. So, I mean, certainly Aquinas, very important to him that we never do evil, that good may come, right? But I don't see the same kind of preoccupation with absolute moral prohibitions.
Right.
So if I think about Hondus' account of natural law, it goes sort of like this. Well, the first principle of practical reason, do good and avoid evil. Well, that's really a principle of intelligibility for an action. We're not going to understand it as an act unless it's oriented towards something perceived as good. And then when we have these goods that are shared with all creatures, and we have some that are shared with all other animals, and we have some that are proper to us as rational creatures. And basically what it is, we ought to pursue all of these goods in a way that's appropriate to the kind of creatures that we are, that is a way that's appropriate for rational creatures. So then there are some things that we can grasp as intrinsically evil because it's built into the concept, right? So don't murder, don't lie. We can know that that's prohibited because we grasp the concept.
Yes.
But that does not tell us whether this is a murder, whether this is adultery and so on.
That's
and
right.
So when we descend to particulars, it's very explicit, that's where error enters in. There doesn't seem to me to be anything there of a kind of sort of promise that reason gives us epistemological access to a set of action-guiding absolute moral prohibitions. Those are precisely not action-guiding at all, and so we're left with the task, the epistemological task, which is a very, very messy one, of saying, what is the way that's appropriate for creatures such as ourselves to pursue these, you know, basic goods that he gives makes no attempt to give a systematic, exhaustive list of.
And
just let me throw out some basic goods. Now go pursue them rationally.
Yeah, I mean, but it right down to the thought that you would never get such a thing. I mean, even if you read the material on justice, right, it's like there's no reason to suppose that there's going to be a singular set of principles that you could see as all of the same kind, that are governing all these different departments that get traced out in the archetyponic there on the material injustice. No, I mean, that is certainly the case, and Anscombe specifically talks about, I mean, like, all that the moral prohibitions do is set these lines that you're not supposed to cross.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tell you how to tell exactly which acts count as instances of the kind in her cases, and she shares, I think, with Aquinas. I mean, my joke way of putting this is sometimes to say, for a lot of my colleagues on their readings of Aristotle, it would be really weird for the frontmost to have to go to confession very often, because it would be really strange for the frontmost to have good grounds to regret things that the frontmost was up to. You could have the full load of acquired virtue in Aquinas. It's not going to obviate the need to go to confession, and you're going to mess up.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually hard. I mean, it's one of the nice things about Aquinas' Neo-Aristotelianism is that the needfulness for deliberation and the difficulty and perilousness of deliberation is really clear in him. I mean, how difficult this territory is. And so it's really nice because you've got a guy who's putting a lot of stress on reason but doesn't seem to be against having to reason to figure stuff out. And the discussion of prudence, it's not a discussion of some master virtue that tells you go there. It's a discussion of a certain kind of order, which can be realized in more than one way. And she's fine with that. So, I mean, I was stressing prohibition because it's so important. It's like the spine.
But her?
Yeah, for her. I don't think it's got the centrality for Aquinas that it has for her. But I think that she's not completely wrong to suppose that there's textual grounds for supposing that this is significant in Aquinas.
Right. So this is something along the same line. And the worry is that some of what you described as absolute prohibitions wouldn't be action guiding at the fine screen level.
Oh.
That's the worry, so that you would have primitive types and you would have a terrible time figuring out what tokens fall under them. And my worry throughout the discussion, Transcon's position was, to what practical effect is it to refer to those as absolute prohibitions? I mean, fair enough, if it counts as rape, absolutely prohibitive, if it counts as murder, absolutely prohibitive, but all the work, as you said, is in the casualty. I think the casualty gets pretty complex.
Yeah.
And that's actually where, as I understand the system you laid out, that's where all the work is being done. And it seems that you then wind up with a system which doesn't have, at the token level, any absolute prohibitions at all.
Oh, I don't think...
How do we get the absolutists at the token level?
There, in any of these cases, there's going to be... The place where it's going to get gray is around the edges. But to be a kind of Anscombe person for half a second, there's going to be central cases,
yeah.
Central instances of, well, if anything counts as rape, this does. Right? If anything counts as murder, this does. That much has to be there in order to teach these things to, or learn them, acquire them. That you don't acquire those things without acquiring some sense of central cases of them. In terms of what you're going to say about some particular thing that happens when somebody's on your deathbed or something like that and becomes a living law. I mean, it's like, that's a place where you've got to try to work it out. But you're working it out within the boundary by trying to figure out how close we are in and how far out we've gone from the kind of thing that would count as a central case. And you're not going to get, I mean, that's part of what I was trying to gesture toward by saying that neither the positive side nor the negative side is, strictly speaking, codifiable. But if you don't have central cases, it's not clear that you've got a concept that's actually latching onto anything. And I mean, it's the same with, you know, stuff on intentional action, paradigmatic cases. It's like, yeah, then you can worry about blinking your eyes. But only because you've got the central ones in view. So I'm not sure that I think that's a huge problem. I mean, it's like, I suppose, this is not how my daily life tends to go, but I suppose I could find myself in a circumstance where I would think, but would that be murder? If I did that.
You know. One might, in another life, find myself in that situation all too often?
Yeah.
Or in a different line of work?
In a different line of work. If I'd taken a different career path, my concern would be whether or not doing this would count as murder. But that's... I mean, part of what interested Anscombe the most about the cases that she considered in some detail in her very late work on these topics was that where things like rape and murder are involved, it doesn't even have to be the case that I know that that is a true description of what I just did in order for me to be culpable for having done it. And in this way, they're a very special class. The prohibited ones are a very special class of that. I think with rape, especially there's people who in fact are culpable in rape, and people who do not understand that that's the description. And with murder, certainly, I think. It's not that all the work is done over the cashier's perspective. Part of the philosophical work is done with trying to identify central cases, take it or move from central cases that people will recognize, try to think about what, if anything, the prohibited archetypes have in common with one another. She looks on that a little bit, but in a very sketchy way. but just to, and then to try to see what you could do to theorize them. All of those things are difficult. Is this touching on your
concern? Yes, it is. Because, so the implication of that would seem to be that we want to think a little more carefully about the way we use type token language in describing the case.
Case instance is like nicer. I mean,
but you also, it's a Virginian kind of family. Central
yeah,
cases,
but it's not token, it's types all the way down in a funny kind of way. I mean, it's a...
Well, my app is going to be a token. When I do something, it's going to be a token.
Yeah, that's going to be a token, but I mean...
The structures
that you're working with, I guess the only really unpleasant one I've paid much attention to a lot of research on were cases of rapes that were committed in fraternities.
Mm-hmm.
And instances where the fraternity brothers, I think, genuinely didn't recognize that what was going on upstairs was rape of somebody who had passed out because she was drunk or whatever. But in those sorts of cases, in the prosecution of the legal actions surrounding them and so on, you began to get a pretty nice discussion of the elements of the situation and what had happened, such that these were rapes. But in those cases, you're also describing something general.
True, but those cases are cases where it's, as your clinical confession seems to be, that's an epistemological point. I mean, there's a fact of the matter of whether or not it falls under the category. The fact that even well-intentioned people can get that wrong doesn't give them that. So that's a kind of a side issue.
Okay, so the concern is that...
whether there really is a robust general type that's fit for legislation. If you have central instances and you teach by extension, is now law the right metaphor? I mean, that worries about whether you can have a natural author without a legislator, because that's part of the concept. But does the law metaphor also require more constraining and more complete type descriptions that don't have this fuzziness in order to be law? It's a real, genuine question.
It's a very good question. I mean, it's a really good question. And what I can say with confidence is that Anscombe does not help with this question at all. I can say that with great confidence. I think that to the extent that Aquinas is committed to the precepts of the Decalogue, counting as precepts of primary precepts of natural law, it's not as robust. It's certainly, you've got central cases that are obviously there, right? And that are part of the delineation of the content of those precepts, I think, in the Decalogue. But how those precepts play out in practice, the general concern over lying gets attached to false witness, which would appear to be a special kind of lie. It's not like...
particularly culpable.
Yeah, and particularly culpable. And to follow that line out is partly... at least in Aquinas, is partly a matter of following up the contours of mortal sin as opposed to venial sin. And the material that he gives us, which is actually pretty robust, about the difference between mortal false speaking and venial false speaking. And it has to do with the matter and the circumstances and the person to whom I'm speaking falsely and all those kinds of things. But there's a fair amount of substance there to guide. And he is exactly where how far natural reason, the natural light of human reason, is supposed to take us along that path. I just don't know exactly. But it's pretty, he gives us a lot of pretty substantive guidance. Does that address it at all?
If I might insert myself in the queue, I wonder whether you would like this answer to Ryer's first question. So Ryer asks, how can an act both be bad itself, but also bad because it's legislated against by God? But why isn't the answer, well, it can easily be both. It can easily be both bad in itself and bad because legislated against by God. What it can't be is both prohibited just because it's the kind of act that it is, and also prohibited because it's legislated by God. But the sense in which it's, the second thing is true is just illogical. That is, that's what it is to be prohibited.
That's very clear.
So actually, just following on that for a second. So you have this distinction between being bad in itself, regardless of circumstances and so on, and bad because of the circumstances.
Yeah.
But there's presumably nothing worse about being bad in itself than there is about being bad in virtue of the circumstances. So again, that idea ends up not being very important. What ends up being important is being prohibited because it's an act of a certain kind, regardless of the circumstances. Is that not true?
I don't think so. I mean, it's like, what can you think about, at least for contemporary Anglophone moral philosophers, I don't think that's true. Because it's like, if you read a lot of these guys in virtue theory who get all excited about uncodifiability,
yeah,
it looks to me like what they're getting all excited about is the fact that the kind of thing that's good to do a lot of times may not to be good to do here and now. And that's a matter about circumstances.
Yeah.
And what they don't notice is that the point about circumstances, to the extent that they're sticking close to their guy Aristotle, makes no difference with this other kind of act. Right? I mean, the adultery, it's not a question of the right woman, the right way, the right amount, right time. It's never okay. Period. I mean, that's a murder, not a case of, you know, done the right way, the right reasons, right time. So they're taking the uncodifiability stuff, and a lot of the particularism literature springs out of this, right, to cover the whole of morality. And it's like, no, it covers the fact that it's, that, you know, you can't prevent the world from throwing up circumstances in which the kind of thing that it's usually really good to do becomes bad. Right? That's what they're actually, that's the deep truth about life that they're holding on to there. And it entirely leaves aside this other category of acts that it's never good to do, where it doesn't make sense to be a particularist about them, and it doesn't make sense to get excited about uncodifiability with respect to them, because they, it's like they're, I always think about this, like there's a circle, right? The edge of the circle is this line of prohibited acts that you don't do one of those. But the whole realm of stuff that isn't right on that boundary is stuff that it might, on some occasions, be a good thing to do. And so they're all excited about what's inside, and they're not noticing that there's a boundary condition on it. That's why I think that the point about circumstances is also really important.
Let me just try it one more time. So what's the important notion is you're saying is bad, right?
Well, really no, smart. I mean, like, we're supposed to be, the first precept is go for the good and avoid the bad.
Right. Fair enough. But, well, let's do it with good, okay? So there's good just in virtue of the kind of act that it is.
No, that's the thing there's not.
Okay, right, so that.
I mean, it's like, look, I mean, my favorite example in Aquinas is a mortal sin of omission. Here's what a guy is doing. You've got this little monk. He's at his devotions. He's like singing. He's praising God. He's, you know, he's praying. He's with his brothers. There's nothing you can see in what the guy is up to and so on that wouldn't look, if you're an Aquinas-y kind of guy, like an exemplary human action going on. This has got to be about as good as it gets. Look at this guy. His face is good. His mom is dying three blocks away, and he knows this. And so he's violating the precept of the Decalogue that tells you to honor your father and mother. So it is a mortal sin of omission. But nothing you look at in the man and what he's doing in the moment is going to reveal this to you. It's the circumstance that makes this a mortal sin of omission rather than just some other kind of sin.
Yeah, so this is a kind of interesting notion. It's not just that it's, I mean, what he's trying to avoid there is that there's a kind of action that is so good in itself that it makes the action good, all things considered, guaranteed to be good, all things considered.
Right.
That's ruled out.
That's the no positive.
Okay, that's
yeah.
That's complicated.
It is complicated.
Right.
He's a complicated guy.
Right.
On this point, can I just ask? Is it just like a contamination argument? Is it like every actual token has at least two different sources, the act itself and circumstances?
Yeah.
If one of them is a dirty river, even if the other one is crystal clear, when they combine, you don't want to drink that water.
Right, that's the point about if it's bad in any one respect, it's bad.
But it can never, but there's nothing that is so crystal clear that can purify the already contaminated
water.
Yeah,
no, not even our monk.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's like a purity kind of.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Ken.